Hare Krishna.
This coming week, we will be beginning our celebration of Sri Gaur Purnima, the most auspicious appearance day of Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. By the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, we receive the association of His dear devotees. In fact, when the Lord displays His most intimate affection upon the conditioned souls, He guides them to the association of those who have given their lives in His loving service. Srila Prabhupada, our beloved Guru Maharaj, simply by His association, He transformed the hearts of innumerable people throughout the entire world. And it was His desire to create a spiritual society where all classes of people from all places could learn the science of Krishna consciousness and the association of devotees who are sincerely and faithfully following in His footsteps. Srila Prabhupada left us the most precious, invaluable gifts. The narration of His transcendental pastimes invokes Krishna consciousness within our hearts. His most illustrious books establish the highest truths. The society that He created, His temples, the deities that He installed, farm communities, schools. He sacrificed His life to give the world these most blessed gifts, because through them is the opportunity to return home back to Godhead. But one of His greatest offerings to human society is He has given us the association of those devotees who have surrendered their lives to serving Sri Sri Radha and Krishna under His divine guidance. There is nothing that we should be more grateful for than the opportunity to hear from and serve His beloved devotees. Today we have several of Srila Prabhupada's very dear associates who have given their lives to help in His great mission, the mission of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. First of all, I'd like to introduce His Holiness Devamrita Swami Maharaj. Devamrita Maharaj is a very, very famous personality within our movement. Very simple, very austere, very enthusiastic to serve, enthusiastic to preach. We spent many years together in many inconceivable circumstances. And one thing I have seen in His Holiness Devamrita Maharaj is he's always fixed in the service of Sri Sri Radha and Krishna, always fixed in trying to somehow or other carry out Srila Prabhupada's desires. Before coming to Krishna consciousness, he graduated from Yale University, one of the most prestigious colleges on the planet today. He was searching for the absolute truth. But he could not find it in Yale University. But when he came across Srila Prabhupada's books, he found something to give his life for. And he surrendered. Being a very scholarly person, he was one of the editors of Srila Prabhupada's writings, working for the BBT. He was also, over the years, he established centers. He pushed forward one of the biggest programs for book distribution in the world. I was explaining last night, the tiny isolated country of Norway, with only a few devotees, was the number one center for book distribution in the world. More than Bombay, Mayapur, New York, Los Angeles, because the devotees were so enthused to give Prabhupada's mercy to others. And it was His Holiness Devamrita Maharaj that was very much an instrument in enthusing them. He was also for some time the president of New Vrindavan. He's presently the regional secretary and leading many glorious preaching programs in Australia and New Zealand. His lectures create both enthusiasm, joy, and fear in the hearts of all living beings. His presentation just penetrates all the outer coverings of the heart and touches the soul. He is truly a dear son of Srila Prabhupada. We are so very grateful that he has come. He's come for the first time in 14 years. Let us very wholeheartedly welcome him to Sri Radha Gopinath. Next we have His Grace Rabindra Swarup Prabhu. Rabindra Swarup Prabhu is one of the great scholars of the Hare Krishna movement, one of the most exemplary grihasthas in the whole world. He's also a person who is willing to dedicate, he's so dedicated, he's willing to surrender to anything that has to be done to protect and carry on Srila Prabhupada's will within our society. In fact, more than anyone I have ever seen in my life. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he considered that his sannyasis and grihasthas were equal in the sense of their willingness to surrender in Krishna consciousness. Nityananda Prabhu was grihastha, Advaitacharya was grihastha, Srivas Thakur was grihastha, Ramananda Rai was grihastha. And then we have Rupa Goswami, Sanatan Goswami, Raghunath Das Goswami, Swarup Damodar Goswami, Gadadhar Das Pandit. They were in the renounced order. But he did not calculate by what ashram they were in, but the quality of their devotional service. Grihetako vanetako sadahadi boldetako. Whether you are grihastha or brahmachari or vanaprastha or sannyas, if you truly take shelter of the holy name of Krishna, you will go beyond all happiness and distress in this world. Rabindra Swarup Prabhu and his good wife, Sodamani Mataji, they're actually true representatives of the renounced order of life, although they are grihasthas with children. And we have many grihasthas here today. They are a model that you should strive to become like. Although they're living together, they're both completely sold out to the loving service of Sri Sri Radha Krishna. Srila Prabhupada's order is their life and soul. They're willing to do anything, go anywhere, to somehow or other try to protect Srila Prabhupada's legacy and serve the Vaishnavas. They both together came as a married couple in 1969. He was initiated in 1971, and that same year he was made temple president of the temple in Philadelphia, USA. I think Philadelphia was the first city of America, was it not? Something like that? By American standards, Philadelphia is an ancient place. By Indian standards, not so much. But he was temple president, and he continued in that service through many turbulent years, and Srila Prabhupada very much took note and appreciated his incredible devotional service as a leader of our society. He introduced Srila Prabhupada to scholars, to politicians, to many affluent people. He went on many morning walks with Srila Prabhupada, had very unique personal instructions from Srila Prabhupada. Later on, he was requested to go back to school to get his PhD at Temple University, a very prestigious college in the United States. After receiving his PhD and being one of the leaders of the Bhaktivedanta Institute in the founding days, he was made GBC and went back to becoming temple president of Philadelphia. He's traveled throughout the world preaching, giving seminars. He's perhaps the best teacher of Krishna consciousness in a very, very systematic, methodical way. But most of all, as I have said, whenever there's a severe crisis anywhere, just one phone call and he's ready to go. It's an unbelievable act of surrender, which practically none of the sannyasis in our movement are willing to do. He's a totally dedicated personality. And now he's the chairman of the GBC body of ISKCON. And this is the first time he and his good wife, Sodamini Mataji, have ever come to Sri Radha Gopinath Temple. So let us very enthusiastically welcome them. We also have Mother Padyavali Mataji, this is also the first time she has come here. She's one of the leading devotees, preachers in Canada. She was one of the most dedicated distributors of Srila Prabhupada's books for many, many years. And just a wonderful, wonderful Vaishnava. Let us welcome her to Sri Radha Gopinath. For the first time in our history, His Grace Mahamuni Prabhu has come to Sri Radha Gopinath Temple. A very, very dear godbrother. He was in the military. He was an officer in the Vietnam War. And when he came back after fighting a war in Vietnam, practically days after he came back to America, he joined the Hare Krishna movement and became brahmachari in temple. He came back and found all his friends were devotees, so he went to the temple and became devotee. In his years, especially, he was one of the bus party leaders of Sri Radha Damodar Traveling Sankirtan Party. He was very well known and loved for his service, distributing Prabhupada's books and preaching and training and caring for devotees. And most of all, he's a very, very dear friend for all the Vaishnavas. Let us very sincerely welcome him to Sri Radha Gopinath. We'd like to request first His Holiness Devamrit Maharaj to speak and then Ravindra Swarup Prabhu.
Om Gyana Timirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Litam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Looking out amongst the hundreds of persons, I'm simply thinking of the great fortune that has been so easily made available here in this section of Bombay. In a world which is overflooded with endeavors for economic development and sense gratification, you have the good fortune of being able to come to a place which inspires you to actually use your human body for what it's meant for. Most of you know about the three modes of material nature, as Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, Trigunamayi, how all our circumstances and lifestyles are influenced by goodness, passion, or ignorance. We can analyze our raw endeavor in life, what we're actually doing and what we are pushing on for. And there we can find the influence of the three modes of material nature, known as gunas because they bind. So we certainly consider our impetus, our life's mission, what makes us push forward. What makes us lift our head off the pillow every morning, we consider that our sacred personal hallmark in life. This is me. This is what I'm trying for. I may be simply trying to maintain my family. That is my mission. I may simply be trying to maintain myself, or I may have bigger ambitions. I want to do good for the world, or I want to do good for my family, or I want to achieve academic honors or athletic honors or recognition in the community. We consider these kind of impetuses to be our own. But Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita that these impetuses, these missions, are actually simply composed of the three modes of material nature. When the pure spirit soul comes in contact with the material atmosphere, it takes on all this unnecessary baggage. What is that unnecessary baggage? Certain material ambitions, desires, missions. What you want to achieve, that is composed of Trigunamayi. In India, there is still some knowledge of the mode of goodness, how to live a sattvic lifestyle. Even a poor person knows how to take bath. People living in the villages certainly know how to live a simple, peaceful life. Recently I was at Ekachakra in West Bengal. That is the birthplace of Lord Nityananda. Most of you know that the Shastra explains Krishna comes as Lord Chaitanya. His Holiness Radhanath Maharaj was speaking about the coming Gaur Purnim celebration, the appearance of Lord Chaitanya. And Balaram comes as Lord Nityananda. In Ekachakra, just a tiny remote village, There, of course, you have the transcendental presence of Lord Nityananda. But also, from the material point of view, you can look around and see that although the people are living so simply, they are quite satisfied. I studied the faces of the children, the men, the women, just living in traditional houses with cow dung paddies attached to the wall. And there was no store in the town, there were no shops, and everyone's walking, carrying things on their head. Yet, they were happy and satisfied. From the material point of view, still, the fact is, they were peaceful. Mode of goodness can be like that. Of course, there has to be an added element of desire for spiritual knowledge. Not necessarily knowledge directly of Krishna, but at least knowledge that there is an all-pervading spiritual energy that we should honor, and that spiritual energy also includes us. You'll still find these influences of sattva-gun, mode of goodness, in India. However, you go to the Western world, and so many of you are students at college, and at least 10 of you have come up to me and talked about, what about the need to go to the West? I said, why? Well, there is the financial consideration, and there's also the need for seeing other places. So I answered that, well, you are practicing Krishna consciousness. At least choose somewhere to go. Since you have this attachment, choose somewhere to go where there is a vibrant community of devotees. Otherwise, without proper association, here you are enjoying luxurious association. So you might think, oh, I'm very strong. I know I'm chanting my japa. I'm coming to Radha Gopinath Mandir once, twice a week. Everything will be all right, but I also have these attachments. Yes, where shall I go? Will it be Melbourne? Will it be London? Where shall I pursue my success in this world, along with my Krishna consciousness? So, generally, you are astonished to find out how even the basic standards of human civilization, in the material sense, are not existing anymore. If you go overseas, you'll find that out. You'll see what it's like to be constantly bombarded with the mode of passion and ignorance, with not even the rudiments of protective culture that still exists in India today. And then you'll see the naked result of dedication to material ambition and material desire. Srila Prabhupada once explained something I always remembered. We all know about lust, the drives of the body, the drives of the mind. Srila Prabhupada explained that economic development is lust on an organized mass scale. Very interesting point. Lust on an organized mass scale. When we start thinking of economic development in that way, we get a deeper insight into how millions, billions of human beings are wasting their lives. And they think that this impetus, this ambition, also some other devotees, they've come up to me. They finished college. So they're asking me, you know, I'm satisfied in Krishna consciousness, but still there is this desire that maybe I should have more money. What do you think? I'm practicing bhakti, but still I must admit that there is this desire for more money. So I asked, well, what would you do with the money? And they scratched their heads, and one told me, oh, I would hold more feasts for the visiting devotees. So I said, look at your life and try to understand the circumstances that Krishna has given you. Maybe you don't have so much money, but you have more time. Time is also wealth. Try to understand the circumstances Krishna has given you and see how you can best utilize that for Krishna's pleasure. Certainly we need to maintain the body, we need to maintain the family. No one is denying that. And certainly it is nice to have what they call in the West disposable income. Just, it's a nice term, isn't it? Disposable income. You can just dispose of it as you like. And when you dispose of the income, supposedly you're supposed to feel satisfaction. First of all, you feel the mode of passion, so-called satisfaction, that you possess the income. I have the income to dispose of. Supposedly you get satisfaction from that? No. You know better. In Rajagun, there is no satisfaction. There's just the hope, the feverish hope for satisfaction. So you feel this imaginary hope, this hope for imaginary satisfaction that I possess the income, therefore everything is all right. And then you also have the anticipation that when I dispose of this income that I possess, there'll also be further fulfillment. Now actually you don't have fulfillment from beginning to end. But you're hoping, and you have these wishes, and you're imagining, I have income to dispose of. That equals satisfaction. Society has told me this equals fulfillment. Society has told me that this is a very cherished goal. I have it, and now I'm going to dispose of it. And maybe I should dispose of it overseas. And that would probably be even more fulfilling. In this way, you put yourself in very entangling circumstances. That is the nature of the mode of passion. You start out with a basic ambition for economic development and the resultant sense gratification. And then you find yourself in circumstances that are pungent. They burn, like when you're eating food that is too spicy. You're burned by your own life. And then you start to feel very embarrassed. But who can you tell? You cannot admit to anyone that you're suffering. You cannot admit to anyone that you're not getting the fulfillment you thought you'd get. You look around and everyone is playing the same game. And so you say, what more can I do? What else can I do? I'll just pretend I'm happy and fulfilled. And in fact, you're convinced that everyone else is happy except you. Haven't you noticed that? So now in India you have the sudden boom in products from abroad entering. The multinationals are descending upon India, a very tempting marketplace of 1 billion people who have not yet been flooded with all the consumer goods. So the purpose of all that inundation, flood, is to convince you everyone else is happy with these things and you don't have them. That's why you're not happy. And it's so easy to fall victim to this. And in the process of falling victim, you give up the real potential of your human life. So it is this this ruination that Krishna consciousness is protesting. The destruction of the human potential. Putting your life's ambitions and hopes and strivings simply into economic development for a so-called better life. Now, after the mode of passion proves itself to be a frustrating affair, what comes next? The mode of ignorance. This is what you see in the Western world. That you cannot work without intoxication. Not possible. I was speaking yesterday how in New Zealand, when corporations want to employ computer specialists, so on and so forth like that, and if they have five applicants, two are New Zealanders, two are Indians, one is Chinese, they'll always take the Indians or the Chinese and not their own people, because they know our own people will not work with integrity and they'll always be intoxicated. So better to take the persons from India. They have stable family structure. They'll be very reverent and honorable at the job. If you can't get the Indians, take the Chinese. Don't take the Don't take our own people. Forget it. But then I've also noticed what happens in time after the Indian or Chinese immigrants have been there. Naturally, they want to partake of the feast. Yes, yes, we have the nice jobs, and now we should also have the very nice habits of all the people that are living in this country. Yes, we should also eat meat. We should also become intoxicated. We should also start to experiment with unbonafide family arrangements and liaisons between male and female. And then, of course, based on this initial impetus for economic development, havoc eventually happens because the fulfillment doesn't come there, and therefore the intoxication has to follow. In spite of everyone's best endeavors, oh, how could this ever happen in our family? They all say like that. But their children, they're thinking, what's good for grandmother and grandfather in Maharashtra? That's got nothing to do with us. We were born overseas, and we want to partake of what all the all our fellow persons in this country are doing. And the parents become horrified. But the parents never recognize that they are responsible for the situation because they sacrifice everything simply to chase economic development. And ultimately, the situation becomes so degraded that any idea of even mode of goodness living, ordinary human standards become lost. Recently, in Auckland, I had to mediate a dispute between two Indian families. Neither of them had any idea of Vedic culture or proper standards in the traditional way. They had totally dropped that one generation back. So, what was the dispute? That one man had been associating with the daughter of the other family for some years, and in the process, she became pregnant, although they were not married. So what was the dispute about? One family was objecting that although she's pregnant, he cannot marry her because he's from a Brahmin family, and she is not. And they were seriously having a huge battle about this. How can there be marriage? Our family is from the Brahmana line, and her family we don't know. So I had to gently point out that Brahmanas don't... And it seems that the die has been cast, the seed has been sown, and so therefore maybe it's time to recognize the situation and deal with it for what it is, and use this as a lesson to understand that because there was no spiritual culture in the family, they sacrificed everything for economic development. Therefore, they also lost their human potential in the process. Now I'd like to end by pointing out another sinister influence of the modes of nature, something that we ordinarily don't think of. Okay, we understand that our very impetus, our mission in life, our life statement, that is composed by the modes. Although we think it's our own, it's very cherished. No, it's simply a combination of Trigunamayi. What about our thinking, our conceptions? Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, Tri Vida Bhavati Shuddha Dehinam Sa Svabhavaja. When the spirit soul contacts the modes of material nature, it develops certain conceptions, certain ideas, certain convictions. Now, we consider our convictions, our ideas, to be our very own, our beliefs, my outlook. But there's nothing special about it. It is simply a product of the three modes of material nature. So that means, if you want to understand how your convictions and beliefs and outlook, how they're formed, just look at your lifestyle. You cannot separate your actions from what you think. But the Western world will convince you that there is a separation between what you believe and think and your actions. But this is not honored in Bhagavad Gita at all. This is given no credence. Look at your lifestyle and we can understand the convictions and beliefs that you hold dear. Just as your lifestyle is evidence of the influence of the modes of nature, so are your ideas and thinking. It all works hand in hand. Therefore, if someone acts in a very age of Kali way, they will also think in an age of Kali way. Often we have people saying that, I want to be good, I want to do good. That is sentiment only, because unless you know the science of how to change the influence of the mode of nature you're operating under, you cannot be good. It's like a patient who's very sick, going to a disease area and saying, I want to be well, I want to be well. If you want to be well, you've got to get out of the diseased area. You've got to change your habits. Basically, what this means is that the Vedic view recognizes that knowledge is state-specific. This is very revolutionary as compared to the Western conception. According to your state of consciousness, you can understand certain things. So if you want to increase your understanding, you have to raise your level of consciousness. It's not that you can just have a polluted consciousness and understand anything. No, it doesn't work like that. This lack of acceptance of how knowledge is state-specific causes the emergence of intellectual leaders and teachers who have no qualification to actually impart truth, because they think there is a division between how they behave and what they think. And the 14th chapter of Bhagavad Gita says otherwise. If your activities are in the mode of passion, you'll have certain ideas. You might think they're your own cherished ideas, but no, it's all the influence of the three modes of material nature. Now, in some sciences, this is recognized only in a limited way. For example, in quantum physics, that is the most accurate predictive science known to human beings today, but no one knows why it is the way it is, but it is used. There is recognized that what you see is not independent of the observer. The Vedic knowledge takes that a greater step further. Not only is this true in the micro world, but it is also true in the macro world, the everyday world. According to the quality of the person, they will perceive things in a certain way. Therefore, if we want to actually make a change in our life, we have to recognize the all-pervasive effect of the modes of nature and adopt a process which will work on our ambitions, our mission, our life statements, our convictions, our beliefs. Krishna consciousness, bhakti yoga, has that potential if properly applied, and therefore it can produce such dramatic results. So before we rush off trying to honor this ambition or that impetus, and before we take our convictions and beliefs and theories very seriously, let us try to understand, by looking at our lifestyle, what mode of nature I am operating under. And do I want to be under the modes of nature at all? Because ultimately, you don't want to be bound by gold handcuffs, silver handcuffs, or tin handcuffs. You want to be free. Real success is to get out from under the influence of the three modes of material nature. And that kind of success is given in the process of bhakti yoga, especially when administered through personal guidance. Thank you very much.
Do the job, don't need to scoot up. That's fine. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prastaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swamaniti Namane Namaste Sarasate Deve Gauravani Pucharane Nivishesha Shunyavari Paschacha De Satarane Oma Gyanam Timurandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Miritam Jainam Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Anshakalpatrubhyascha Kripasindubhyevacha Patitanam Bhavanevyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Namaha. I'd like to speak a few words in appreciation of the Bhagavad Gita this afternoon. I was led to think about certain things. Yesterday at lunch I was telling people I was dining with some of my adventures and so-called education. And some of those involved the Bhagavad Gita. So I started thinking about the Bhagavad Gita a little more. This is a wonderfully remarkable book. Not just for what it says, but for what it does. It's really gives us access to a tradition that would be lost to us. We know from the Vedic version of history that at one time there was a far, far more advanced spiritual civilization on this planet. But as the course of time foreordains, the civilization has gone into decline. We call it Vedic culture. So of course, the arrangement of Krishna was that at the beginning of this Kali Yuga, or the end of the last Yuga, Dwarpa Yuga, there would be some method of making this great achievement of our forebears available to us. If you look at the effect of Kali Yuga, one way to see it is that basically all of us are now brain damaged. The power of matter has decreased. The nutritive powers of fruits and vegetables and grains are less. We're all basically stupid. We can't understand the achievements of former times. How to, therefore, connect us in this condition? Well, one of the things that happened to help us was Krishna speaking this Bhagavad Gita. The Vedic literature is a vast library. It contains many, many fields of knowledge. And it's so clever that it enables people in different states, as Maharaj was pointing out, recognize that the knowledge is state-specific. People in different states and different positions, who therefore can only understand things from a particular perspective, to get aboard somewhere and make progress toward the end. So there's an element of relativity in the Vedas because people are in different conditions, and so the Vedic knowledge is delivered according to their understanding. As a result, different schools of thought developed over the course of time. Nevertheless, there was this conviction that ultimately there's a single Siddhanta, that all the Vedas are tending toward one single end, one decisive conclusion, and that at that point all the relativity comes to an end. And we've reached the absolute truth. Well, what is that decisive conclusion? Well, this group says this group says that, this group says this. How do we decide? Well, what can you go? Taraka Pratishta, reason and logic is really there's no foundation. Shruta Yovabina, the scriptures exist in different divisions. And nobody can be a rishi unless he has his own independent position. So where do you go? It's difficult, huh? That complaint has been there for a long time. So, to guide us in our condition, Lord Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita. If you look at the Bhagavad Gita, you'll see that what the Bhagavad Gita is really, in the course of this very remarkable discussion, it's quite short. Krishna, in effect, does a survey course on all different Vedic paths. He goes through everything and assesses them one after another. And he spells it out in plain terms. Many times in the Bhagavad Gita you'll see that Krishna, what he's teaching as guhyam, guhyattamam, raja guhyam, is secret, it's confidential, private, exclusive, and these guys are not available to everybody. And we may think, well, if it's so secret, how come I know it? Well, we know it because Krishna's made it an open secret. Before, it was not so open. But now, because we will not have access, we will not be able to sit and study the Vedas three times. We will not be able to go through the Upanishads. We will not be able to take a gradual process of elevation. He's spelled it out. And there's no question, in my mind anyway, there's just no question that he hasn't actually told us everything. Just for example, if you go through the Bhagavad Gita, you'll find there's a discussion of sacrifice, yajna, an analysis of all different sorts of yajna. And we find out that when you understand yajna very deeply, you are actually on the platform of Brahman. And if you understand the purpose of yajna, you'll understand that Krishna is the benefactor of all sacrifices. And he says it quite clearly that he is the benefactor, the enjoyer of all sacrifices and austerities. Bhoktaram yajna tapasam. He says it right out front, very clear. If you study in a Western university Sanskrit, after 1 year you can read Bhagavad Gita. Many years to read Srimad Bhagavatam. And the Upanishads is something else again. But Bhagavad Gita is very... Bhoktaram yajna tapasam. It's very simple Sanskrit. So he spells that out. He just opens it up and says that if you understand yajna, you understand sacrifice, you'll see that ultimately if you follow it all the way out and get into it in depth, comes to me. He analyzes yoga. The 6th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. And the statement is there too, that the best yogi, of all yogis, the best who is my devotee. That's the very conclusion. He states that. What else does he analyze? He analyzes work without attachment to the results. That work should be done to satisfy me. The worship of upasana, different devas, that's analyzed. The path of knowledge. When you have completed the path of knowledge, gyanavan man prapajyate, you surrender to me. So you see all the way through. Krishna shows that every single different path, if you follow it out to its perfection or completion, you'll end up being Krishna's devotee. If you're still not sure, he just says it out flat. Look, here are all these different dharmas. They come to me. So, sarva dharman parityaja, mame kam saranam bhaja. Arjuna, make a fast work of it. All these different dharmas, they just come to me, so just give them up. And mame kam saranam bhaja, you can come directly. Don't waste your time. I'm giving you this opportunity. This is the teaching of the Bhagavad Gita, very clear. In the 15th chapter, Vedaishta Sarva Ahameva Vedyaha. All the Vedas are just the searching after me. And who is Krishna? Well, he's the good authority, Vedavit Vedantakrit, the best authority. So here's Krishna on the highest authority. He says, I'll analyze the Vedas for you, and I'll tell you where they're going, and I'll give you a process you can follow. That's Bhagavad Gita. It's clear, it's simple, the Sanskrit is easy, anyone can understand. Wrong. Because this is Kali Yuga. So my adventures with this was that I was one of these people in college who was searching for the truth. And so I was an undergraduate at the University of Pennsylvania, whose business, famous business school is Wharton. But I majored in philosophy because I was looking for the truth. Now I say that if I knew I was going into spiritual life, I would have gone to Wharton and learned how to raise funds. But anyway, been more useful, huh? So I was studying philosophy because I was looking for the truth, which was considered to be very amusing, you know, in the philosophy department, that somebody was actually thinking there was a truth. One professor said that he studied philosophy so he could win arguments, and so on. So I was very disappointed in this search for truth in Western philosophy. I went to graduate school for a year in literature, which I thought was more interesting because you could talk about the real problems of life, but there was no way to solve them, and just writing about them in however beautiful language, you didn't solve your problems. You could just sing gorgeous death songs, but not do anything about death. So then at this Temple University, there was a kind of religion department started that was going to be experimental in a way. That Hinduism was going to be taught by Hindus, Buddhism taught by Buddhists, Islam taught by practicing Muslims, and so on. So that there would be this experiential dimension, not just completely dry academics. So I had a friend who was in that department. He said it was interesting, so I went to that school. Now, my actual field was theology and philosophy of religion. But because I was interested in looking at all different religious traditions, I took specifically three different courses in Hinduism. First, there was one general survey course in Eastern religion, and that's I read the Bhagavad Gita the first time. And then I had my first Hinduism course, which happened to be taught by one Swami Nikhilananda. He was the head of the Ramakrishna Mission in New York City, which is 100 miles from Philadelphia, and so twice a week he would come down with a few disciples and teach the Hinduism course. He used his book, Hinduism, Its Meaning for the Liberation of the Spirit, as the textbook. He's a very scholarly man, translated the Bhagavad Gita, the Upanishads, and so on. He's a disciple of Swami Vivekananda. And so this is how I learned Hinduism, Mayavad philosophy, Neo-Vedanta style, from Swami Nikhilananda. Next course was a Professor Chakravarti, who was from Buffalo, I think. Also, as you could tell by his name, Chakravarti's Bengali intellectual. And again, we learned how Atman and Brahman are one. That was Hinduism. And again, I read the Bhagavad Gita, yet another translation. Then another class, another Bengali lady was a teacher, Mrs. Dasgupta. Her husband was the late Surendranath Dasgupta, wrote a famous five-volume history survey of Indian philosophy, which he did not very much appreciate, Lord Chaitanya's movement, by the way. But she wrote about half of it, actually, without much credit, but she was the one. So she was also teaching. And again, I had to read Bhagavad Gita. So about the third or fourth time I was reading Bhagavad Gita for this course, we were assigned a paper on the ethics of the Bhagavad Gita. And what was taught in her husband's books, or the books they authored, that the ethics of the Bhagavad Gita was this. That you have your own particular ethic for your varna, your swadharma, according to your varna. That's a particular ethic. And then there's also a universal ethic which applies to everybody. But in the Bhagavad Gita, they come into conflict. What Krishna is supposed to do as a kshatriya conflicts with what's the universal ethic. So the ethical teaching of the Bhagavad Gita is, when there's a conflict, the swadharma takes precedence over the universal. Finished. Bas, that's all. That's what she taught. So anyway, I had to write a paper about the ethics of the Bhagavad Gita. So once again, I read the Bhagavad Gita. And this time something began to occur to me. And it was that actually the Bhagavad Gita is teaching surrender to Krishna. Now I want to tell you that, and I got this idea and I looked at it again and there it was. And what I want to say is I thought this was my original discovery. Because I had read the Bhagavad Gita under Dr. Phillips, then under Swami Nikalananda, then under Dr. Chakravarti, then Mrs. Dasgupta, I mean, very prominent experts, much more educated than I were. Nobody said this. It was completely ignored. So I thought I'd really discovered something. And in fact, I became it was like a breakthrough experience, you know, that this is what it said. And I was always so impressed by the Bhagavad Gita, and there was some great wisdom in this book. I just couldn't quite grasp it. And then I thought to myself that if the Bhagavad Gita is teaching surrender to Krishna, then that's what I should do. And I remembered I was sitting at my dining room table with this paperback Bhagavad Gita, translated by Penguin Books, Juan Mascaro translation. Closed my eyes, kind of hunched my shoulders, and I said, "Surrender! Surrender! Surrender!" And I opened my eyes. Nothing seemed to happen. So, but within a month, this was 1969, within a month, on the way to a class at the same university, Temple University, I saw some Krishna devotees jumping up and down and chanting. I did not quite connect that with this, but I was within a month. And I saw them. A friend of mine invited me to the love feast, that they called in those days. And I came into contact with Srila Prabhupada and Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita. By the way, I wrote this paper on the ethics of the Bhagavad Gita as required. And in the first part, I just repeated, you know, what she said the ethics was. And in the second part of the paper, I said, actually, there's a deeper ethic. And I said, it's about surrender to Krishna. I made that case. She was a little upset and gave me a B. In graduate school in America, there's only two grades, A or B. And C means fail, so at least she gave me B. She didn't like the second part of my paper. But anyway, I saw the devotees. I began chanting Hare Krishna. Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita, the original, Macmillan had published, an abridged version was there. I talked to the devotees. And the meaning of Bhagavad Gita became clear to me. what Krishna is actually teaching. And I thought what I would do is I'll just go through a few verses with you just to show you what the Bhagavad Gita is actually saying. Because it's a secret. It still is a secret. And maybe, most of all, secret in India. I have to say this, you know, because there's a... You go and you hear what Hinduism is or what people think Hinduism is and what people are taught in Hinduism, that it doesn't matter what God you worship, they all lead to the same place. That when you actually arrive at knowledge, the relationship between the worshiper and the worship disappears and you become one. None of this is in the Bhagavad Gita. It's a fact. Here. Let's look at this seventh chapter, which is about knowledge. So starting in text 19, Krishna is talking about one who has knowledge. Bahunam janmanam mante jnanavam mam prapajyate. It will take many births, and after many births, you become jnanavan, you know, one who has jnana. As a jnanavan, you know what a jnani is? He actually gains knowledge. How do we know he has knowledge? Mam prapajyate. He surrenders to me. If he doesn't surrender to me, again. And that's the pure logic. If he's saying, Vasudeva Saravam Iti. He says, Vasudeva, Krishna is everything. Means that he sees everything in relationship to Krishna. Or that Krishna is everything to him. But then he says, Sa Mahatma Sudurlabha. This is a great soul, but it's quite rare. We see that. It's quite rare. So this is here Krishna states quite clearly what is Jnanavan. Who is this Jnanavan? Mam prapajyate. He surrenders to me. Is there any confusion? Very next verse, he talks about those who don't surrender to him. Kamais taista hritta jnana. Notice, here's that word jnana again. But those who hritta jnana, their jnana is gone. They're robbed because of kama. They have various material desires. They are robbed of their, deprived of their knowledge. Prapadyante, same word, this time it's plural. They surrender. Anya devata. Not to Krishna, but to others. Who says that it doesn't matter who you surrender to, it's all the same? Not Krishna. If you want to call this Hinduism, we have to say, Krishna's not a Hindu. I don't want to shock certain parties, but we've got to go back to school here, I think. And see what Krishna actually teaches. If he's authority, and I think he is, then he says there's a difference. If you have jnana, you'll surrender to him, but hrita jnana, prapadyante anya devata. Then he discusses that a little bit. If you have surrendered to anya devata, all is not lost. Because he says, this is what happens. I want you to understand this procedure. You're worshipping some devata. Because you kamastaista, I mean you have some desire. You want this, you want that, you want the other thing. So you're worshipping these other gods because you have some desire. Krishna wants you to know what's going on behind the scenes. He says, whatever devotee you wish to, whatever deity you wish to worship, I give you the shraddha to do it. He endows this with shraddha yarachitam ichchati. He gives that shraddha. Tascha tascha achalam shraddham, that steady shraddha. He gives this achalam shraddha, steady shraddha. So that way you can become successful. So where is your faith, your shraddha coming from? is actually coming from Krishna because he's in the heart as the super soul. So he's making your faith steady. And you please that devata, you get what you want from that devata. But where does the devata get his benedictions from? He gets it from Krishna. Krishna says that those benefits are bestowed by me alone. So actually, from the side of the worshipper, the faith is given by Krishna, and from the side of the devata, the benediction is given by Krishna. What's the implication? Who should you worship in that case? And then he says, then he discusses why he describes these people as hritta jnana. In this verse he calls them alpamedasam. These are different ways of saying stupid. Deprived of jnana, alpamedasam. They have meager, medasa, meager intelligence. Because their intelligence is meager, because the phalam, the fruit of what they get, is limited and temporary. So if the same effort of worship devoted to Krishna, you'll get something eternal. What kind of fool are you that with that same effort you could get something eternal you're using to get something temporary? That is not very bright. This is Krishna's verdict. I certainly have no standing to call anyone stupid. But if Krishna's doing it, what can I say? I can't argue with the Lord, huh? And then he says something flat out that contradicts what so many people say, sometimes in Krishna's name. Devan deva yato yanti. Those who worship the devas, that's where they go. Madbhakta yanti mamapi. But my devotee comes to me. One goes there, another goes here. It says it. This is like grade school Sanskrit, you know. There's no hard words in this text. And again, Krishna says the same thing, and just in case you weren't paying attention, in the 9th chapter. So now he's discussed the wise person who surrenders to him. Then he discusses one group of people who are not so smart, who surrenders to the devatas. Now, just in case you're not got it, he's going to discuss another group of stupid people. Abuddhayaha. Avyaktim vyakta apanam manyante mam abuddhayaha. Those who are abuddhi, they have no Buddha, they think of me, avyaktim vyaktim apanam, that first of all I was impersonal, avyaktim, and then I became manifest, a personality. This is another theory, widely spoken in the name of Vedanta and other things, that first of all, the absolute truth is something impersonal, unmanifest, Brahman, and then somehow he precipitates out and becomes a person, then dissolves back into impersonal again. If that's what you think Krishna's judgment is, abuddhayaha. So here he talks about the fruit of workers, and here he talks about the impersonalists. These people are not jnanavan. There it is. It's simple. It's clear. Now my question is, why don't people know this? Here Krishna's gone to the trouble to speak the Bhagavad Gita in very simple Sanskrit so that everybody can understand, to make this most intimate secret public. And still it's a secret. Well, actually, we know from the very beginning of the Bhagavad Gita why this is so. That if we want to understand Bhagavad Gita, we have to hear from Bhakto Sime Sakacheti, as he says to you, can understand this because you are my devotee and my friend. Then you can understand but Krishna says it has to be understood from that person who's coming in evam parapara parampara praptam, one after another in parampara disciplic succession. This is also spelled out very clearly by Krishna at the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada says it's like you have to take the medicine that is prescribed according to the directions on the bottle. Krishna gives the directions. Somehow they can't see. So this Bhagavad Gita is a wonderful book. It is the key that unlocks the door to Vedic knowledge. If we hear it from the right person, who can teach it, Prabhupada says, as it is. That's a title that irritates scholars like anything. I mean to say the professional academic scholars. They say it's very unsophisticated, as it is. In fact, even one scholar from India has written a book, Bhagavad Gita, as it was. But actually the Bhagavad Gita is. It's still alive because there are teachers like Srila Prabhupada. Alive means you hear it from the right person in the succession, and you also become qualified, as Devamrita Swami has pointed out. You have to become in the right status of at least mode of goodness. Krishna also says that, that knowledge depends upon sattva. Knowledge depends upon sattva. I don't know, I spent 4 years studying philosophy, so another 4 years taking classes in graduate school in philosophy and theology. Nobody ever mentioned that fact. The knowledge depends upon sattva. So you become qualified, hear the Bhagavad Gita from the right person, and then Bhagavad Gita will actually take place. It will be alive, and there will be, even though so many thousands of years have passed since Krishna spoke to Arjuna, we can have the same effect as if we are there ourselves. And no, the time difference shrinks to nothing. This is the effect of this document, if it's heard in the right way. So what is perfectly clear and plain and simple to anyone who is properly heard, to other people there is very confused and misled. So hear from the right person. And if we do this and we teach it in the right way to other people, the whole world will change. This is the mercy of Lord Chaitanya and of Srila Prabhupada. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Hare Krishna.
I think it has to go up these taller person here.
That's good. Hare Krishna. I was thinking about the Bhagavad Gita so nicely explained here by Rabindra Sarup Prabhu. And one of the things I think about when I think of the Bhagavad Gita is that it was spoken by a person. That when I think of our movement, even, that it comes to us from a person. It comes from Srila Prabhupada, who takes it from his spiritual master, who takes it from his spiritual master, who takes it from Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And who, on back, we see that Bhagavad Gita was spoken by Krishna. And I was thinking, so many people I know can quote so many slokas. They give so many nice slokas, they chant them, they speak, and sometimes they even lean back to let you know they know so many slokas. You see? But sometimes we forget that these slokas are coming from a person. That sometimes we think they're just words. That the words are coming from this book and we can just quote these words. And then lately in the last month or so, I've been thinking about these words. The words, they come to us in this form of the holy name. This Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Ram, Hare Ram. They don't sound like words when you do it. The idea is that sometimes even we're chanting this Maha Mantra, and we think of them as just words. You know, we just want to get through these 16 words and these 108 beads and do it 16 times, and we just want to get through these words so we can say, I finished my rounds. I'm done for today, you see. Sometimes we forget that while we're saying these words, when you say Krishna, He is there present before you. Huh? And depending again, as was stated, that upon our consciousness, the state in which we're in, whether we can see Krishna or not see Krishna, or whether we can understand this position. Even modern psychologists, they say that we have a filtering system, and according to our nature and how our environment and how we grew up, that whatever information we receive is filtered through this filtering system that we have, and we perceive it only according to our background and our perceptions. So in our Krishna consciousness movement, we can't be dependent on our own filtering system. We take our knowledge, it's handed down in a descending process, and we take it from the spiritual master. And we understand that the holy name of Krishna and Krishna, they're the same. That when you say Krishna, He's there present before you. And then it becomes a reciprocation, a relationship. That when we come before the deity of the Lord, sometimes we see stone or we think, oh, how beautiful, how wonderful they're dressed today. But sometimes, at least in my case, when I come, I'm unable to see that this is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I bow down because I was told to bow down by my spiritual master when I come before the deity. I bow down. And when I get up, I pray that somehow I can take shelter of the deity. But I am not always seeing that this is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because of my coverings and because of my attachments to my own material desires. So when I think of even the problems that even our ISKCON movement, because it's very easy to sit here when I give Bhagavad Gita class, it's easy to separate the devotees from the non-devotees, isn't it? You look in the Bhagavad Gita and it's very clear. Just like Rabindra Swarup Prabhu was saying, it's very clear. It's, you know, these guys have no knowledge. These guys have knowledge. But even in our own movement, sometimes we look at each other and we become confused. You see? So we have to take the relationship that we get from our spiritual master, this relationship of the holy name, the relationship of the deity, the relationship of the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. Even Vyasadeva felt this vacuum and emptiness within himself. After he compiled all the Vedas, even he thought, well, the age of Kali is coming, maybe I should split up the Vedas for those who are less intelligent. I should divide it up so that everyone can understand this. And he did all these things, and he did the Mahabharata, and still, there was something inside. Or he felt there was something not inside. It was described as a vacuum. And he approached his spiritual master, or his spiritual master approached him, Narada Muni, and he explained to him this position. That because you have not properly glorified the Supreme Personality of Godhead, in this way, the vacuum can be resolved, this emptiness can be resolved. You see? Even the son of Vyasa, he was perfectly situated. He didn't even want to come out of the womb. Sukadeva Goswami, until he heard that Krishna is a person. Uttama Shloka Lilaya. He became to hear about the pastimes. So it's our business also to not just be stuck on words and not just be stuck on slokas and not just be stuck on books, but to try to see that these books, the Srimad Bhagavatam is described as the incarnation of Krishna in this age. When they said, where will we find you when you're gone, you're leaving, where will we find you? How will we know? In the pages of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So Narayan, Krishna himself, has appeared in this book. And it's our job to try to find Krishna in those books. To try to find that personality, that person. Rather than just a bunch of books. I was talking with one god sister of mine earlier today who is a great book distributor. And we were talking about how that feeling inside of us, when you're trained early on to distribute books and to preach, that it's like a drive to give this information to the non-devotee. There's a pushing. It's like for myself anyway, I'm never satisfied unless somehow I can put myself back into the position where I can deliver Narayan to someone's home, where I can give this information. Not that I have any spiritual realization. It's just implanted in there by my spiritual master. Srila Prabhupada has planted a seed, and because I'm such a poor gardener, my seed doesn't grow so nicely into this plant. But the plant is crippling along anyway. It's somehow, by the grace of Krishna and Guru, the plant is still making some progress. And that progress, for me, is I can feel it when I'm able to preach and give this message that Krishna is a person. That Krishna and His holy name are non-different. And that if you have any problems, just like ISKCON sometimes has some quarrels, if we have problems, we come together and we chant the holy name of the Lord and we put Krishna in the center and we fix our minds, then all these things, they will go away. Just like even yourself, you're chanting. And when you first started chanting, even though you don't think, oh, Krishna is the person, you're just chanting because you were told to chant, all these problems, you start to go away. You start to feel different. Maybe you're not feeling ecstasy, you know. Maybe tears aren't flowing from your eyes and your hair standing on end. I'm not saying that you're experiencing that. Maybe you are. I don't know. But you start to feel a difference. You start to feel some separation from the material world. There's something inside this holy name that makes you chant it again and again and again. And every time you pick up your bead bag, there's something in that bag that drives you from bead to bead. You see? You feel it. You don't know what it is, but it's there. And Krishna is a person. And as you become purified within your heart, then He becomes manifest to you. And this is what the Bhagavad Gita is saying. This is what the Srimad Bhagavatam is saying. This is what the Guru is saying. So we take shelter of the holy name. We take shelter of the process. So when I listen to my godbrothers speak, I feel like, God, they're so intelligent. They're so learned. I don't know anything. But I do know that if you just chant, then everything else is there. Krishna is within His name. You've invested all your transcendental energies, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said. Everything is there. But unfortunate as I am, I have no attraction. How do we get attraction? By the association with the devotees. You see? Because if you're chanting and you're starting to space out or nod, sometimes you start to fall asleep, isn't it? If you think about, if you thought that Krishna was a person, you probably wouldn't sit right in His face and nod out, right? Huh? If I called you here before me and said, oh, I'm so happy to see you. You probably wouldn't do that to somebody, right? Or you probably wouldn't call somebody into the room and then start talking to somebody over here. You see? This is a symptom that we may not understand, that Krishna is a person, and that He's in His transcendental name. They're non-different, you see. So by associating with devotees when you chant japa, sometimes you look at your mind starts to wander, and what do you hear? Your godbrother or godsisters chanting, right? And the holy name enters it. Oh, immediately you're back on track. Or sometimes when you start to, your mind is wandering, and all of a sudden you look over and you see how nicely your godbrother's sitting and he's chanting. You think, oh, I should do this? This association is the most important part of our development. Chanting, dancing, associating. So if you want to understand Bhagavad Gita, part of the formula is that you must chant the holy name of the Lord in a humble state of mind, feeling oneself lower than the straw on the street, devoid of all sense of false prestige, and being tolerant like this tree. And so many things are coming, but we must be tolerant. We must take shelter of the holy name. Because without that, then we won't have anything else. Because the holy name is the process in the age of Kali Yuga for self-realization. It's so simple in the age of Kali Yuga. We complicate it with all of our madness, but it's very simple. You chant, you dance, you take prasad, and you learn some philosophy. The philosophy is very simple. Huh? Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and surrender unto Him. Very simple philosophy. It's not hard. It's our application that makes it hard. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
We'll have a few questions. Devamrit Maharaj, Rabindra Swarup. Is there any questions?
Hare Krishna. This question is to Mahamuni Prabhu. You mentioned that the process is easy, but it's the application which is where we are lacking. So while chanting, not throughout the day we are in a mode of goodness. We are subjected to this different modes like passion and ignorance. So is it better always to wait for us to situate ourselves in the mode of goodness and only during that time chant, or best is to just go through the chanting, finish off with the 16 rounds as early as possible?
Well, first, I didn't say that the application we were lacking. I was just saying how we apply it. But for myself, if I waited for the mode of goodness to come around before I chanted my rounds, I'd be waiting a long time. I'm situated permanently in the mode of passion, I think, in the mode of ignorance. So I can't wait for that, you know, like, when's it coming, you know, here it comes. It's 4 o'clock, goodness is coming, you know. Taking shelter of the holy name. The more you chant the holy name eradicates all, even if we're offensive. In the beginning, we're offensive when we chant. And we commit offenses to the holy name. So just like you might commit offense to a person, you go to that person and you beg forgiveness, and then they would pardon you. So the same way when the holy name, we commit offenses to the holy name. We go to the holy name and we beg forgiveness. And we go on chanting. And the process of cleansing the heart, chito dharpana marjanam, is to chant. And by chanting over and over and over, then the sinful desires are removed, and the mode of goodness becomes present because all these things are removed from the heart. And eventually, sudha sattva eventually will attain. But always the process is to chant, even if we're steeped in the mode of ignorance. Actually, if you're in the mode of ignorance, that's when you should chant the most. Is that if you find yourself slipping into the mode of ignorance, grab for your bead bag, call for help, get a god brother and say, chant with me. Because if you find yourself slipping deeper and deeper, that's when you should call out, oh Krishna, somehow I've fallen into this ocean of birth and death. Please pick me up and place me as one of the atoms of your lotus feet. That's the process. That's what we're here for, is to call out to Krishna. So you can't wait for some time. This timing, we may not have enough time in this lifetime. Maybe you wait for such yuga to come back around. And when such yuga comes, most people are situated in that mode of goodness. And you might be able to chant then. But I'm not waiting that long if I can help it. And so you just get in there and you chant as much as you can, as often as you can, no matter what state of mind you're in.
Hare Krishna. Please accept my obeisances, Ravindra Swarup Prabhu. When you were discussing about the shlokas, in one of the shlokas, Krishna says that those people who worship Anya Devata, I give them the faith to do so. But in one case which occurred in Maharashtra, a very big politician of Maharashtra, his wife was a very staunch devotee of Sri Ganesh Dev. So once they had been to their farm on Khopoli, and his wife was suffering from some disease and she had attacked there. But unfortunately she had forgotten the medicine here at her residence. So he tried to call his home, he had a hotline, that failed. Then they had an ambulance. They tried to go to a Khopoli hospital. In that ambulance, the ambulance broke down and finally she died. So from that day onwards, this particular famous politician stopped believing in God or whatever, Anya Devata, whatever it is. And he started proclaiming that there's no God because my wife was such a staunch devotee and she died. There was no medicine. The telephone broke down. The ambulance broke down. So why did Krishna destroy his faith?
I'm afraid to say something about a famous politician who I don't know. So I'll just speak in general terms. Many people sometimes say their faith is destroyed, but there was a, there was a famous singer, Bob Dylan, and one of the famous lines in one of his famous songs was, you've said you've lost your faith, but that's not where it's at. You had no faith to lose, and you know it. So if faith is broken so easily, you wonder. People who go to God, or to the gods even, and you give me what I want. It's not actually love. And as soon as something goes wrong, immediately they lose their faith. But it was not actually very strong. To actually have faith in Krishna means you trust Krishna. Krishna, whatever you want, I accept that's good for me. Otherwise, Prahlad Maharaj should have immediately said, hey, well, you know, what's this stuff? I'm a kid and I got this abusive father. He's doing all this stuff to me. You know, how can this happen to a devotee? You know, I'm not going to, I'll give up. We should have seen all the Pandavas become atheists. And look at their trouble. But Kunti Devi prays to Krishna, I hope that these troubles come again and again. And actually, for a devotee, if we are correctly situated, Krishna will show us that everything that happens to us is a benediction. In the material world, there's shubha and ashubha. You know, there's the good things and there's the bad things. The auspicious and the inauspicious. But when Krishna is present, everything is auspicious. In the world's eyes, this may be a disaster. Like the Pandavas, they lost everything. But the devotees see, this is Krishna's benediction. And you can actually see how it's benediction. He'll let you know. And sometimes if you don't know right away, well, that's okay, I'll find out. This is what Krishna wants. In the Bhagavatam, Krishna is called, Prahlad Maharaj is called Krishna Graha. That means one who's under the strong planetary influence of Krishna. So everybody, they have their, on their astrological charts, there's some planets that are benefics. You know, Jupiter is benefic, Guru. Shani is bad. Rahu, Ketu, they're bad. Buddha is good. Buddhi is good. You know, Mercury is good. So everybody's looking to see where are the good planets, where are the bad planets, when's the good time, when's the bad time. But for everyone who becomes a devotee, there's another planet on their chart that's Krishna, Krishna Graha. And when Krishna Graha is there, everything becomes auspicious. So that's what faith really means. as far as I'm concerned. Hare Krishna.
Well, we see that while practicing devotional service, sometimes the sentimentalism arises. And because of sentimentalism, we, rather than seeing through the Shastra, we base our faith on mental level, sentimental level. But also, as recently in Mayapur, Deena Bandhupur was explaining, that Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur said that aggressive intellectualism is mother of atheism. So if you put too much of intelligence, then you become hard-hearted. So how do you balance both of them? Yes, for you.
I'd like to answer that by saying there is a complete difference between the intelligence that Krishna is asking for in Bhagavad Gita and the intelligence that is rewarded by materialistic society today. In the material sense, intelligence is deemed as being very keen and very appropriate when it conceives that it can grasp everything, that there's practically nothing you can't understand if you go to the right university, if you study the right books, if you have the right amount of time. Certainly you will understand, because that is the nature of human intelligence. And whatever is temporarily beyond the reach of human intelligence, in time it will come into focus. This is aggressiveness. Bhakti intelligence is also intelligence, but it's of a different sort. Remember Krishna explaining to Lord Brahma, all of me, my name, form, qualities, let it be revealed to you because of your non-deceptive performance of bhakti yoga. Rabindrasrup Prabhu was explaining about the secret of Bhagavad Gita. How is the secret known to you? It's an open secret, but why are some understanding and some not? Because some have taken the effort to become the devotee and friend of Krishna, and some haven't. So there is a bit of a disagreement about what actual intelligence is. Even Arjuna got a little bit confused about that in the beginning of Bhagavad Gita. In the beginning of chapter 3, Arjuna said, Krishna, you've talked about Buddhi yoga, analyzing how we're not the body, analyzing that we're spirit soul. You've talked about how we should be detached from the fruits of action. That all sounds very good to me. It sounds like inaction. It sounds like not fighting. Therefore, tat kim kamani gore mam. Why do you ask me to engage in this ghastly warfare when you've just given me a whole spiel, a whole presentation about not becoming caught up in the results of activities, about not forgetting the spiritual identity? And so therefore, why now should I fight? Isn't that intelligence not to fight, to refrain from engaging in action? So therefore, Krishna clarified that action in Krishna consciousness is evidence of the highest intelligence, because the senses are engaging in the service of the master of the senses. That is indicative of intelligence. And when the senses are engaged in the service of the master of the senses, you get realization, you get experience. Otherwise, you'll never understand Bhagavad Gita, no matter how many PhDs you have. We heard about how our Prabhu here studied under so many teachers, and they never could teach what Bhagavad Gita actually is. I myself have an experience. I decided my sophomore year that I was going to study Hinduism. So there was only one problem, in that the class met at 8 a.m., and I never took any classes before 11 a.m. because I didn't get up until 10:30. I was a student. So somehow or other I was really interested in Hinduism, so I managed to get up at 7:30 in the morning and staggered to the classroom, and there the teacher handed out Bhagavad Gitas. This was during the radical student days in America, when so many students were involved in protests against the government, Vietnam War, civil rights for minorities like that. So I was seeing everything through that context. So the teacher, he hands out the Bhagavad Gitas, and it's by an Englishman named Edgerton, a particular Gita I had, that the teacher was recommending. So I just flipped through it. He had the verses in the front and his commentary in the back. Now, I just took one look at his commentary, and there he said, Krishna is a concept meant to please the intellectuals and the sentimentalists. So I knew nothing about Krishna. Immediately I slammed the book shut and walked out of the classroom thinking, just see this imperialist British professor ruining the native people's book. Yes. How dare him? I knew nothing about Bhagavad Gita, I knew nothing about Krishna, but how dare him make this judgment on this original native masterpiece, this imperialist overlord? So I just walked out of the classroom, and that was the end of my studies of Hinduism. Now, I explained, I think some days ago, I don't know, maybe it was at Mahaprabhu's house. Later, I was about to graduate. So I turned on, I think I explained it in Bhagavatam class, I turned on the television to get some relief from writing my thesis. And I explained how we would watch television with the volume turned down because we were high-class students as opposed to the masses. And the ordinary masses watched television with the volume turned up, but because we were high-class students, we would keep the volume turned down and speculate what was going on the screen. So then I saw these strange-looking people on the TV screen. Women wearing saris, men with shaved heads wearing strange clothes. So I turned to my roommate and I said, oh, you better turn the volume up. We'll never figure out what these guys are talking about. So we began to hear their message about purified living, the regulative principles, rising early in the morning, controlling the senses. So I just turned to my roommate and said, these people are fools. They have missed the goal of life. We should invite them to one of our parties. We'll teach them the absolute truth. That was my state of consciousness, and obviously there was no way I was going to understand Bhagavad Gita, no matter how many academic degrees I had, as long as I had this rebellious, polluted state of consciousness. So, according to material calculation, I was intelligent. According to Bhagavad Gita's judgment, I was a mudha. We are developing intelligence here. Krishna consciousness is for the most intelligent persons. But it's a different kind of intelligence. An intelligence based on becoming Krishna's devotee and Krishna's friend. And then Krishna allows you to understand. Krishna allows you to see.
What about the sentimental part?
Mm-hmm.
How can we apply sentimentalism in knowing Krishna? Sentiments. Our sentiments.
You can serve Krishna with sentiment. You can serve Krishna with blind faith. Whether you touch fire blindly or you touch fire sentimentally, if you touch the fire, you'll get burnt. But the best way is to take everything Krishna is giving. Krishna is giving you knowledge of himself, knowledge of yourself. Why not take that and base your activities on such knowledge rather than just have some notion that, oh, this is nice, the temple is nice, the devotees are nice, but then next week you may feel different. Still, the fact is you got benefit during that week where your sentiments were running the right way. But you're not going to stay to get the full reward you're entitled to if you're just based on sentiment. And actually, in the highest sense, bhakti is full of sentiment, eternal spiritual sentiments that you can read about in Nectar Devotion. So another thing I want to warn about is trying to turn Krishna consciousness into some kind of emotionless, qualityless lifestyle. Bhakti is the perfection of emotion, the perfection of sentiment. And when you read the whole Nectar Devotion, you'll see how sentiment and emotion transforms from the materialistic polluted condition to the height of spiritual perfection. So we are not so much against sentiment as we are understanding that a insubstantial understanding of Krishna makes spiritual development a little difficult. Therefore, Prabhupada has given us so many books. And those books, they're full of sentiment. They're full of emotion. And the life of a devotee has sentiment and emotion, but these are sentiments and emotions founded on the bedrock of eternal service to Krishna. So maybe I've answered your question about sentiment in a different way.
Srila Prabhupada ki.